It's the 29th of June 2004, and joining me on the line is David Ray Griffin from California. David, thank you for joining me.
Good to be with you.
I interviewed Michael Meacher earlier today, and he wrote the foreword for your new book, which is The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions for the Bush Administration on 9/11. Is that right?
That's right.
Now, this obviously is quite a controversial book. Why did you feel you had to write it, and what led you to start writing this book?
Well, like a lot of people, I for a long time simply accepted the official story because I really hadn't studied anything about it. I heard a few rumors that there were people who thought it was an inside job of some sort, but I thought that was rather beyond the pale, that it was such a horrendous act that to think that the Bush administration, even the Bush administration, would do such a thing was simply too far out to take seriously. But then a friend sent me a website that told me about Paul Thompson's lengthy 200-page single-space timeline of events relevant to this, and a title had been put on it, was 9/11 Allowed to Happen? And reading through that, I became amazed to see there were an enormous number of events, all taken from very mainline sources, such as The Independent and The Guardian and the New York Times, that pointed in this direction. And so I started doing some research and decided the case was strong enough that at least it merited an investigation. And because I had published a number of books, even though I was a Johnny-come-lately to this topic, I decided I should try to write a book and see if I could get it published, because the people who had done the original research, most of them had not published and were evidently finding it difficult to find publishing outlets. So I just took that task on.
Did you have any trouble finding a publisher?
Oh, yes. Even though I wrote to exactly the kind of publishers you would suspect would jump at the chance of publishing such a book, for the most part, I didn't even get answers from them. And that's surprising for somebody who has published over 20 books before, that they simply wouldn't even answer your letter.
I mean, collectively, your books have sold, what, tens or hundreds of thousands of copies in the U.S. previously?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I've ever had much of a bestseller. I've had a couple that have done fairly well.
But the combined book sales have surely make your mark as a previous author.
Well, yes, but I've never counted up to see how many books I've sold. But the point was just that I was surprised at this, that they would treat an established author in such a way. But in any case, I finally came across, thought of this publisher Interlink Books, which had published a book previously by Richard Falk, who wrote the foreword for the American edition to The New Pearl Harbor. And they did jump at the chance, and they showed great courage where other presses haven't. So I have been pleased that the book has been doing well for them and for Eris Books in London.
When did you first discover that there were inconsistencies with the official story when compared with the independent research? Did you find this out straight away, or did it take some time or some crystallizing event for you to see that that was the case?
I think I didn't start looking into this until March of 2003, but once I started, It only took a day or two to see that the inconsistencies were very extreme. So the evidence is so strong that it doesn't take a lot of sleuthing. It just takes, because there is so much material available, and if one gets my book, I've got 40 pages of notes, so I give references to the books and articles and websites of dozens of researchers, And so anybody can go and look at this material for themselves. And most people who will do this conclude rather quickly that if the case is not definitive, at least it's strong enough that it merits a stronger kind of investigation than we've had with the 9/11 Commission.
And the point here is that with your research and like others, including myself, who've done this research and have been following events closely, we've all conducted a more thorough investigation than the American government has, haven't we? Effectively. We've looked at more aspects.
Well, of course, but the point of comparison would be, say, between you and the American press. And, you know, if the Bush administration is complicit, one wouldn't expect them to do anything. One would expect them to behave just as they have been, which is stonewalling and doing everything they could to put obstacles in front of the 9/11 Commission. Even though the commission, in a sense, is run by the Bush administration, that may sound extreme, but most of the work of the commission is done by the staff, and the staff is directed by Philip Zelikow, who was a member of the former Bush administration, a close colleague of Condoleezza Rice, having written a book with her. And so he is the one who actually directs most of the research of the 9/11 Commission. And so it's not surprising that if it turns out to be a whitewash, which at this point all indications are that it will be, this should not surprise anyone who understands what has been going on.
What you're saying is that clearly it's not an independent investigation as it's been labeled.
That's right, and in my book, I did use the informal name that had been accepted, that is, the 9/11 Independent Commission. Many critics have been calling it the 9/11 Cover-Up Commission. I myself, when writing the book, I mentioned that fact, but I did not endorse it, because at that time I was still hopeful that when presented with the other kind of evidence, the commission might rally and turn around and do a real investigation in which they do raise the question of governmental complicity. But many people made sure that the commission got the relevant kinds of information. Many groups, in fact, made sure that they got my book. And yet, if one listens to the hearings, you see that none of these questions, more disturbing questions, have been raised. And so I now just call it the 9/11 Commission and scratch the word independent.
Right. And, of course, time is nearly up for the commission.
That's right. It's just a matter now of writing the reports.
And we saw with Kennedy's assassination that the first commission, the Warren Commission, told a story which few people can believe. Certainly now after 40 years, although many maintain that the account of the Warren Commission is the real account of what actually happened, but the official story for some still stands. I guess you hope, as do I, that it won't take 40 years to crack open the legend of 9/11 for all to see.
Well, of course, most Americans do not believe the Warren Commission report. And that is not healthy for a democracy. And it's significant that one member of the commission who was originally appointed was Max Cleland. And he made the statement in a very strong interview that he was not willing to be part of a commission that was going to be like the Warren Commission, that is, that would do a whitewash. And indeed, he did not remain on the commission.
Didn't they buy him off with a plum job?
That would be a possible interpretation. It is the case that he did need a salaried job because he had lost his seat. So the Bush administration very quickly took action on the nomination of him for a position which required then that he leave the 9/11 Commission.
The Commission is due to report the 26th of July, I believe.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that they would scratch any further beneath the surface of the official story than we currently think they will? Do you think?
Well, there's always a chance, but as we say, if I were a betting man, I wouldn't bet on it. I think they probably will come out with something that will be new, that will create attention in the press. And there will be something new that challenges the Bush administration. But I think people should suspect that as diversionary. For example, in their latest report, they had this statement that contradicted the White House's statements about Iraq and Al-Qaeda having some sort of connection. And Vice President Cheney came out with a very strong denunciation of this report. And this created quite a hullabaloo and filled all the talk shows for several days, and thereby diverted attention from the fact that they were also asking at that hearing why standard operating procedures for dealing with possibly hijacked airplanes were not followed. And of course, the answer, I say, of course, to those of us who know the details, those answers were very unsatisfactory, and yet the commission just took them at face value. And the press presumably might have followed up on those and raised some questions, but because of this other story that became the lead story that made it look like the commission was really seriously challenging the Bush administration and embarrassing it, those other questions did not get explored in the press.
Well,
so something similar to that may happen in, after July 26th.
Well, let's get into some of those questions. You mentioned there the response of the fighter jets. I assume you're aware now of some of the information regarding the war drills, the war gates which took place on and around the September 11th. For example, the National Reconnaissance Office drill, which was scheduled to take place on the morning of September 11th, where they were going to simulate planes crashing into government buildings.
Yes, there were some war drills going on, presumably, I believe, that had started a day or two before 9/11. Vigilant Guardian was the name of one, and then there was another one. And some people have speculated that those war games might have distracted the controllers and NORAD, but I'm very suspicious of that. For one thing, many people have said, well, there just weren't fighter pilots available that morning. But the fact that these war games were going on means that, according to some newspaper reports anyway, there were more jet fighters on alert than normal. So that actually counts against it. In any case, we also have reports that very quickly, when they finally realized that there was a real hijacking going on, at about 8:21 that morning, the war games were canceled. So I'm skeptical of the idea that the war games can be blamed for the fact that the response was so slow.
And
with regard to Flight 11, the first of the flights that crashed into the North Tower, they knew by 8:14 that it was possibly hijacked. By 8:21, they knew it was definitely hijacked, and yet another 25 minutes went by before it hit the North Tower, and yet with normal operating procedures, a plane is normally intercepted within 10 to 15 minutes, so there was plenty of time that it should have been intercepted, and yet it was not.
And Phil Berg, the lawyer for Ellen Mariani, points out that, you know, at the very least, the second plane that hit the World Trade Center should have been at the very least in the Hudson River, but they should have been able to respond to the second, third, and fourth planes, if not the first. Which means that at least the official account that the last plane, which crashed into the field, should have been shot down with the amount of time left, although the government maintains that the passengers crashed it themselves.
Well, there's with regard to Flight 93, the fourth flight, there is considerable information, again, from mainline sources that suggest that it indeed was shot down. And I devote a whole chapter of the book to that flight. And, of course, what's disturbing about that is, whereas with the first three flights, the question is, why were they not intercepted and then shot down if they wouldn't stop? With Flight 93, the question is, why would it have been shot down? Because it appeared that the passengers were wresting control of the plane away from the hijackers, and yet then that the plane was holed, that is, with missiles, because you have not only reports from the plane itself to that effect, but you have people on the ground who reported seeing material falling out of the airplane from 8 miles away from the crash site, and that at least part of one of the engines was found at a considerable distance from the crash site.
I mean, we're talking somewhere between 5 and 8 miles, aren't we?
That's right. Well, and the engine, there are different stories. One story says it was about a mile away. Another story says it was 6,000 feet away. But in any case, the important point is that it would have been probably a heat-seeking missile, and therefore would have sought out one of the engines of the plane. And so there's that, all that evidence, and considerable more that I cite in the book.
Well, yeah, plus we also have the new development yesterday of the website letsroll911.org identifying a fighter pilot who they say was the pilot who shot down Flight 93.
Yeah, that story right now I think is far too speculative for me to comment on.
But nonetheless an interesting development and one to watch closely.
That's right, it could turn out to be important.
Yeah. What do you think was... Well, what for you was the biggest inconsistency that really rang the bell for you that there was something wrong with the official story?
Well, you know, there are so many. Since I wrote the book, I've been asked many times, what are the smoking guns? And I hadn't used that language before, but I've been asked it so many times, I went back through and counted up, and I was surprised to see how many there are, and I came up with a list of 40.
40 smoking guns.
Yeah, any one of which, in fact, I call them prima facie smoking guns, meaning that they look like stories that, if they were investigated, any one of them could be decisive in showing government complicity. So
we're talking about 40... fraying threads for the mainstream media to pick up on and make huge noise about.
That's right.
If they wanted to.
40 questions that could have been at the core of the investigation of the 9/11 Commission. And at most, they dealt with one or two of them, and there, as I say, they just accepted the answers of the government and military officials at face value without any real probing. So it would be hard for me to list what I think are the top two or three, but I've already mentioned, of course, the apparent stand down of normal operating procedures with regard to flights 11 and 175. Then the fact that the Flight 93 appears to have been shot down, and yet the government denies it. And then there are a whole bunch of smoking guns with regard to the theory that it was Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon.
You're referring to what appears to be an absence of, debris that would account for that entire plane in the early photos taken after the impact.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I first heard about this theory that it was not Flight 77 and was not even a Boeing 757, but was either a small military missile or a small military airplane, I thought, well, that has to be absurd, because if there was such a discrepancy, how could have they convinced anybody otherwise? How could they have convinced the press?
It sounds flat out bonkers, doesn't it?
It does. But then when I started looking at the evidence that Terry Masson and others had gathered, I saw that this was actually some of the strongest evidence against the official account, because, you know, anyone listening to this, if they would ask themselves, well, why do they believe that it was Flight 77? The only evidence for that is that that's what the Pentagon has told us. But all the physical evidence points in another direction.
Well, the five frames from the CCTV camera that they did release, although now the Pentagon cannot figure out who it was who released those five frames. Seems no one is putting up their hands to it, but if you look at it, it's very difficult to make out the outline of an aeroplane. There's just basically a fireball there, isn't there?
I myself have not focused on that. I think there is something to that, but I say that's something in my book that I didn't deal with, because I thought there was even stronger evidence. One of the most important pieces of evidence is simply the fact that there is a photograph taken by a Marine that shows that the facade of the West Wing, which was part of the Pentagon that was hit, did not collapse immediately, and that the hole that was created in it was no more than maybe 18 feet in diameter. Well, a Boeing 757 has a wingspan of 125 feet, and it's at least 40 feet high with its tail. And there was a story in the Washington Post the next day that said the hole was five stories high and 200 feet wide. Well, that's about right. That's what a Boeing would cause. And yet the photographs show that the hole was nowhere near that size. So that's one important bit of physical evidence. Another is that since the hole was so small, only the nose of a Boeing 757 would have gone inside. Therefore, the rest of the Boeing, its wings, its fuselage, its tail, would all be outside. And there were photographs taken very quickly after the crash, and there is simply no sign of a Boeing out there. In fact, there's a website that Terry Masson put up called Hunt the Boeing.
Well, some people would say there's actually no sign of any luggage or passengers' bodies, or any sign a plane was ever near that building.
That's right. There's video evidence of I don't know exactly when it was taken, but Eric Huffsmith, for one, has a video that shows the inside there, and it does not show any such evidence. And likewise, the fire chief was asked the very next day, the guy who was in charge of putting out the fire, what he saw, remnants of the plane. And he says, well, no big pieces, you know, no fuselage, no engine, nothing like that. And a couple other people, as I state in my book, say similar things. And so there was no Boeing outside. There appeared to be no Boeing inside. There appeared to be no Boeing.
Well, they try to explain it away as that the fireball was so intense that the plane vaporized itself.
And here we would have to find some physics books that would allow a fire to vaporize, not only melt, but vaporize steel and aluminum. I think this would be one more thing in the history of the universe that happened for the very first time on 9/11. It's amazing how the press has let some of these stories go by. For example, at the same time the Pentagon was telling us that, yes, the plane was vaporized because the fire was so hot, they also told us they were able to identify the bodies and then we had two versions of this story, either from their fingerprints or from their DNA.
Well, I've seen a story saying that they identified the bodies from DNA. But I also noticed in that same story that they hadn't identified any Arabs.
this is another problem that I didn't deal with in my book, but when I get around to doing a second edition, I will focus on. I mentioned it just briefly, the problem that at least 5 or even 7, and some people say even more, of the alleged hijackers have been found to be alive and still functioning quite well as pilots or whatever, and yet we still have this official story that there were these 19 hijackers, 15 of which were from Saudi Arabia. And so the press keeps repeating this story, even though it has been falsified.
Well, either they've mastered the techniques of time travel, or it wasn't them.
The disturbing thing is that we don't know that there was a single Arab or Arab Muslim on any of these flights, and yet this has been used as the basis for a war on terror, which, even though it's denied, anybody who looks at the facts can see it's primarily a war against Arabs and Muslims. One other factor that's most important about the Pentagon crash is that the Pentagon has to be one of the most defended places on the face of the earth, and it's well known that it's surrounded by batteries of missiles.
A missile defense system which for some reason never triggered that morning.
That's right. They're set to go off to bring down any aircraft that is not a military aircraft. Now, they know, because military aircraft have a transponder that sends out a friendly signal. But if a commercial aircraft of any sort came near the Pentagon, it would be automatically blasted from the sky.
I wonder if that,
whatever it was that hit the Pentagon, obviously got through. So it had to be, one can infer, some sort of military aircraft.
Well, it makes me wonder if it ties in at all with the story that they floated, that the codes to Air Force One had been seized by Al-Qaeda. If you remember, that was, I don't know if you saw this, this was a story floated very early on by the White House.
Yeah, I believe that's all been debunked in the meantime.
Well, it's just that they were talking about having the private codes to Air Force One, you know, cracked, broken, given out. These guys had them. And whatever it was that might have hit the Pentagon, if it was carrying the transponder code, getting back to transponders again with airplanes, if it was blasting out the transponder signal for Air Force One, then the missile system would never attack it.
Yeah, I don't, to my knowledge, there is really nothing to this story, so it's not something I would comment on.
Right. Okay, but nevertheless, I've heard even that the Pentagon has underground facilities, but you would expect the headquarters for the U.S. Department of Defense to have these systems, and if they didn't engage that morning, then the question that has to be asked is, how was it disabled and who disabled it?
Yeah, and of course the larger story is the whole scenario is incredible, to say that Flight 77 left Washington, D.C., turned around in the Midwest, and headed back towards Washington at 8:56, and then 42 minutes later crashed into the Pentagon at 9:38. So that a giant airliner could fly through American airspace, and particularly towards the Pentagon, and be there for 42 minutes and not be brought down by a whole slew of jet fighter pilots, and then if somehow they fouled up, not be brought down by the missile defense system at the Pentagon. This is all just beyond belief. This is Alice in Wonderland stuff, and yet our press has not forced the Pentagon to answer the most elementary questions about this.
Now, have you studied any of the issues surrounding the building World Trade Center number 7?
Oh, yes. And if one is talking about smoking guns, that one has to be very high on the list.
Well, Well, tell us more. I mean, the building collapsed at 5:30 in the afternoon on September 11th, but what are the problems surrounding that building's collapse?
Well, there are enormous problems. Now, to comparing it, and it's good to begin with that rather than the Twin Towers, because there's been so much disinformation given out about the Twin Towers, and people think that somehow the plane impacts and then the jet fuel somehow could bring down these enormous redundant buildings. Nevertheless, with building number 7, no such fantasies can be imagined, because building 7 was not hit, and so there was no jet fuel in it, there was no destabilization, and yet as you say, at 5:20 in the afternoon, it came tumbling down, not tumbling down, it rushed down at almost free fall speed. Now, the first problem is that never before in American history or world history has a steel-framed high-rise building ever been brought down by fire. And this is true even if you had enormously hot fires that ravaged the whole building. And with building number 7, you had nothing approaching this. You had tiny little fires. There are photographs that show only on the 7th floor and the 12th floor of this 47-story skyscraper. And yet, the building came down. Never before in history has this happened. So that's the first major problem. Secondly, is the nature of the collapse. It mimicked what is called a controlled demolition, where explosives are placed throughout the building. They're placed in an order and set in an order to fire in an order in which the building will come straight down into its own footprint, so it doesn't damage anything around it. And this is exactly what Building 7 did. It came down in about 14 seconds. It was a total collapse, and it had all the characteristics of a classical controlled demolition, whereas the Twin Towers were somewhat different. And furthermore, there has been no official explanation. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was given the task of coming up with an explanation of how Building 7 collapsed. And they say in their report, we have no explanation. Now, they went through a scenario in which they say, here's a possibility, in which improbability was placed on top of improbability. And at the end of it, they themselves say the only explanation is one with a very low level of probability. On top of all that, a few months later, the owner of the building, Larry Silverstein, who was the original builder, said, and this is beyond belief that he would have let this slip out in public or why he would have said this, he said in a PBS show that the fire chief called him and said, we don't think we can save building number 7. First of all, that is extremely implausible because, as I say, there were tiny little fires in there that the sprinkling system should have handled. But nevertheless, Silverstein says the fire chief said this, and that Silverstein replied, well, we've had such a terrible loss of life, maybe we should just go ahead and pull it. And that's a slang for bringing a building down with controlled demolition.
And he said,
we sat there and watched the building come down.
And the video of Silverstein saying this is on the internet if anyone wants to check it out. I know it can be found at prisonplanet.com for one, and
that's
perhaps
right.
Other sites out there.
Yeah, Alex Jones' show.
Yeah.
And dealt with that at great length.
And that's quite a glaring inconsistency, that FEMA points towards perhaps fire, and Silverstein says that they actually ordered the building to be blown up. And the news, for the most part, didn't even mention Building 7, and many people didn't even know that it collapsed.
That's right. And even with Silverstein's admission here, there has been no public coverage of that. So it is just amazing. And this is why I say, if people will just begin to look at the most elementary facts, they will see hole after hole, at least 40 of them, in the official story.
But they have to be brave enough to think for themselves and switch off the other messages, for example, television.
That's right, because we have not been well served by our mass media.
No, but it's clearly the case, if many people didn't even know that World Trade Center 7 had had collapsed, that many people don't even know of the existence of World Trade Center 7.
That's right. That's an important point, because, as I say, they came up with some disinformation and some imaginary scenarios of how the Twin Towers might have collapsed, and there were even some well-watched television shows about this. And so in the general public's mind, oh, that has been explained. Of course it hasn't, but...
Well, I'm still trying to establish whether they actually used truss in the construction of the Twin Towers.
Well, there are trusses. The question is, were they these terribly flimsy trusses that the theory calls for? But
all the photos that I've seen only show solid steel beams, roll steel joists.
That's right. So that's what I mean by the part of the disinformation.
Yeah, and they, if anyone out there understands physics, they take a lot longer to heat up and melt than a truss, because they're solid.
That's right. And furthermore, even if one could give any credence to the official theory, which is this pancake theory, that somehow the top floors or the floors just above the impact of the planes gave way, and then the weight of those broke the joints on the next floor down, and then they broke the joints on the next floor down. A 110-story building, if it took a half a second for each of those, you would still have a 55-second collapse. And yet you have, you can see on the videos, the collapse occurs between 10 and 15 seconds. Furthermore, you have those giant steel columns, 47 of them, up the middle of the building. And this pancake theory just ignores those. And if the pancake theory were true, you would have had the cement floors falling down, but you would have had these giant steel columns still sticking up 1,300 feet in the air, and yet we had a total collapse with what remained was maybe 60 feet at the most. And so there are about 10 features of the collapses that, even if you gave credence to the official story of how the Twin Towers collapsed, could not explain all of these other features.
Well, I remember when I heard that the towers, that the first tower had collapsed, and I'd envisaged, until I actually saw what had happened, until I saw pictures, I'd envisaged that the tower had toppled over, which is what many people would have expected to happen.
Well,
or a section of it at the top.
Sure, and if they had been brought down by fire, which somehow melted the steel or made it give way, they would have bent and fallen down and caused extreme havoc. So the buildings, in order not to cause enormous destruction, had to come down straight down. One other feature that is very important with regard to building number 7, if the buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, this would have meant explosives placed next to all of these steel columns. This produces a particular effect in the steel called twinning. An investigation would have revealed this if that's what occurred. And yet the steel was immediately carted away, trucked away, put on ships, sold and sent to Asia, where it could not be investigated. Now, this is normally a crime, and yet the FBI allowed it to happen.
Well, there should have been an investigation into why, for the first time ever, three steel skyscrapers collapse on the same day.
That's right.
Unprecedented.
And with regard to these steel columns and beams, the excuse they gave for why they had to remove them so quickly is they said, well, we think there still may be some victims who are still alive, so we must do this to discover. And yet, building number 7, everyone knows that they were told to evacuate early in the day, and it did not collapse until 5:20 in the afternoon, 5 hours later. And so there would have been no victims, and yet the steel was removed from building number 7 just as quickly.
Now, the other question to ask about building 7 is, how long would it take a demolition squad to rig the building with explosives? Could it really be done within the time between the impact of the planes and then it collapsing after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, or would it take some time longer than that?
No. It would have had to been done in advance.
But would they rig buildings as standard for demolition on the off chance that they may need it? Or are we really looking at the possibility that that building was rigged to explode in advance?
One needs to look at that possibility, and this would go into the question of the history of the World Trade Center, and this would be a whole show into itself, so we better not get into that.
Well, I don't think Larry Silverstein is commenting on any of this, as I understand.
As far as I know, not.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Regarding the political issues surrounding September 11th, you're aware, I take it, of General Mahmoud Ahmed and his wiring of $100,000 to Muhammad Atta via Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh in Pakistan.
Yes, this is one of the issues I deal with at some length in the book, because it looks like there was a very deliberate attempt by the U.S. government, there are many signs of this, to try to hide all the connections with the ISI, which is the Pakistani equivalent to the CIA. In fact, it was originally trained by the CIA. And the head of that organization was, strangely enough, in Washington the week before 9/11, and actually continued on several days afterwards. And as I report in the book, there were efforts to try to keep that quiet, and further efforts to remove all reference to Pakistan, and particularly the ISI.
Yeah, and his name was purged from transcripts in press conferences with Condoleezza Rice, I believe.
Yeah.
But he was actually, on the morning of September 11th, having a breakfast meeting with Senator Bob Graham and Congressman Porter Goss, who were then the heads of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
Yeah, so this is quite a story itself, which should be subject to investigation, but has not been. It's just one of dozens of stories that should have been tracked down, but have not been.
Well, yeah, they could run a fantastical coincidence story once a week for a year about 9/11 in the newspapers, but we haven't seen it.
That's right, and in the next, the final chapter of my book, I give quite a list of coincidences that you would have to believe in order to accept the official story. See, many people say, well, I don't accept conspiracy theories. One answer to that is just to remind them that the official account is itself a conspiracy theory, that 19 Muslim hijackers organized by Osama bin Laden carried off this enormous enterprise single-handedly, and many parts of which have already been disproved. Another answer is that if you don't accept this alternative conspiracy theory, that is, that it was a conspiracy by U.S. government agencies themselves, then you have to accept a long list of coincidences of enormous incompetence. For example, that everything, whenever anybody had something to do with 9/11, whether they were FAA controllers or pilots or NORAD administrators or FBI agents or CIA agents or U.S. military trying to capture Osama bin Laden, they suddenly got enormously incompetent. And it strains credulity to believe that there could be simply that much coincidence surrounding this event.
That they're able to carry off their job perfectly well enough to not lose it for the other 364 days of the year. But when it comes to anything to do with September 11th, miraculously they were all sitting around having coffee and donuts instead of doing their job.
And one would think, if one accepts all these stories, all these people who were so incompetent, and this led to the death of some 3,000 people, they should have been fired, or at least they should have been fined or publicly reprimanded, and yet we have not heard a word about a single incident in which somebody was fired for incompetence or even publicly reprimanded. And in fact, many of the people were promoted.
And they're still there today.
That's right. Nobody, as I say, nobody to my knowledge has lost their job, and some have been promoted to positions of even greater responsibility.
David, where do you see us going from here then? You've brought your book out, and it's now been released in the UK as well as in the US. And Michael Moore's movie is due to be released here in a couple of weeks and has just been released in the US. What do you think is going to happen over the next 3 to 6 months? Where do you see things going?
I really have no idea. I can only tell you what I hope. I hope that Michael Moore's movie will create much more interest among the general public. Now, there are problems with the movie. There have been many critiques of it, both from the right and from the left. But it is an important movie in that it lets a wider portion of the population understand some basic facts that they perhaps didn't know before, and to realize that maybe they haven't been told the full truth about Iraq and about the originating events that led up to Iraq, that is, the events of 9/11. So I hope it will create a lot more interest in studying books such as mine and other books and internet stories that are out on the subject. With regard to the press, I have the hope that the press in Great Britain may lead the way in the English-speaking world, because the American press has shown no sign whatsoever of any willingness to be courageous here and raise these stories. We've sent the book to hundreds of editors and publishers and journalists, and thus far not a single story in the mainline press. And yet in England we had a story even before the book's official release.
The Daily Mail.
By the Daily Mail.
Yeah. The story is up on my website at thoughtcrimenews.com, and people want to see the story.
And we have strong hopes that the further stories are to follow. So it could be that the press in the UK may finally force or embarrass the American press to finally deal with this story.
If people want to get hold of a copy of your book in the US, where should they go?
In the United States, there are some bookstores that carry it. They do tend to sell out very quickly. If you can't find it, you can always get it on Amazon.com in the United States, and of course in the UK, you can get it on the UK Amazon, or directly from Eris Books.
Or from my website where my delivery arrives, also thoughtcrimenews.com.
Great.
Right, well, thanks very much for joining us, David.
You're welcome.
Glad to talk to you, and good luck with the book sales, and maybe we'll be speaking again soon with more information on an update.
Thanks, I'd be glad to.
From Monday the 5th of July, copies of David Ray Griffin's book, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, will be available for purchase from thoughtcrimenews.com.